This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Rachel Mealy. This Friday, better late than never. Our national leaders say now's the time to accelerate the uptake of electric vehicles. But what will it take, and how does an electric vehicle handle a burnout?
I'm owning my fourth electric vehicle at the moment. I've shredded many tyres in them. Four-wheel drive, 800 horsepower electric, to show Australia just how easily you can do the circle work and shred those tyres in an electric vehicle.
And while we've recently seen the devastating effects of torrential rain and floods, there's actually another natural disaster that's proven more perilous to human lives in Australia: heat waves. Australians closely affected by the 2002 Bali bombings have reacted with shock and anger at the likelihood that one of the key planners is set for an early release from prison. It's almost 20 years since more than 200 people, including 88 Australians, were killed in the devastating explosions, the single largest loss of Australian life due to terrorism. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says he will raise the matter with the Indonesian government, but one expert says it's unlikely to change the outcome. Matt Bamford has this report.
At about 11 p.m. on the 12th of October 2002, three explosions rocked Bali's busy night spot. The blasts, carried out by Islamist terror group Jamaah Islamiyah, killed 202 people. There were 88 Australian victims, including six of Paul Vanney's teammates.
The six guys that died in Bali were six of my closest friends. Obviously played football with them at the time, and I've maintained a relationship with the club.
It's been almost 20 years, but the Coogee Dolphins president says he can't forget what happened.
We say that the boys will never be forgotten, and we stick true to that. And every year we're reminded of what had happened because we attend the memorial service. And it's very much in the front of our minds.
Now there's another painful reminder. One of the planners, Umar Patek, is set for an early release from an Indonesian prison. Patek admitted to helping mix chemicals for the bomb. He served half of a 20-year sentence. Paul Vanney is not impressed.
Just complete utter disgust that anybody in their right mind could give leniency to such a mass murderer and proficient assassin such as him. It's just an absolute disgrace.
Melbourne man Jan Lozinski lost five of his friends in the bombing.
It's a bit of a shock. At first I thought, no, it surely can't be true, to think it's just less than half his sentence being served.
Indonesia's Ministry for Law and Human Rights says Umar Patek has behaved well in prison and has promised to turn away from crime. Jan Lozinski is unconvinced.
This guy, he should not be let out unsupervised at all. Can you imagine, for us, particularly family members and friends of those that lost people, and you might be in downtown Bali in a bar and this guy could be having a coffee just across the road from you.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese acknowledges the pain felt by many Australians. He's vowed to raise the matter with Indonesia.
We continue to make diplomatic representations in Australia's interest, and will continue to do that across a range of issues relating to security and relating to sentences.
It's unclear how much sway Australia has. Professor Damien Kingsbury is an Indonesia analyst from Deakin University.
It can express its disappointment, I think. It can say that it would like to see people convicted of that crime which killed so many Australians serve their full sentence. That would be noted by the Indonesian government, but ultimately would have no effect.
It's the second release of a Bali bombing participant in 2 years. Jamaah Islamiyah's former leader, Abu Bakar Bashir, was freed in 2021 despite concerns over his influence on extremists.
There is a strong sense in Australia that the Indonesian authorities perhaps did not go after the perpetrators with quite the vigour that Australians would have liked. That's not really supported by the facts. Bali bombers have been executed. A number have served very long jail terms. So the Indonesian government has taken terrorism quite seriously, but it hasn't pursued the issue in relation to Australia. Rather, it's pursued the issue because it's been a problem for Indonesia more generally.
Those efforts also include a de-radicalisation program that has about a 50% success rate. Despite these assurances, Professor Damien Kingsbury says many Australians will struggle to move on.
In comparative terms, it was approximately the same as the 9/11 attacks in the United States in terms of numbers of people killed as a proportion of population, in terms of its impact on society and how we viewed the world. The whole idea of, if you like, post-traumatic stress is that your sense of certainty about how the world works is taken away from you. And I think that that very much happened to Australia.
Paul Vanney says he's trying to focus on the future.
You know, it's a very, very difficult time for everybody coming up to 20 years, you know, and just focus on the positive things and the things that are within your sphere of influence, and we'll get through it, of course, but it's just frustrating and it makes a lot of people angry.
Coogee Dolphins President Paul Vanney ending that report by Matt Bamford. Australia is set to introduce some form of fuel efficiency standard following a commitment from the Energy Minister. The federal government says the measure, which is used widely around the world, will make electric vehicles cheaper and more available, as well as reducing pollution and contributing to emissions reductions targets. Industry stakeholders have told a national electric vehicle summit in Canberra that both politicians and drivers need a change in attitude to make the transition away from fuel. Isabel Rowe reports.
After decades of stalling, Energy Minister Chris Bowen says now is the time to talk about fuel efficiency.
Apart from Russia, Australia is the only OECD country not to have or be in the process of developing fuel efficiency standards.
Fuel efficiency standards place a limit on emissions for cars accepted into the country, so car makers are forced to develop more efficient vehicles. 80% of the world's car market has these standards, so manufacturers often send their higher-emitting cars here. Chris Bowen says it puts Australia years behind on the road to cleaner vehicles.
While Australia doesn't show leadership, manufacturers will prioritise those markets that do. It's pretty simple. It means that consumers aren't getting the choice available internationally, and as the world moves to more efficient and cleaner cars, we risk becoming even more of a dumping ground for older technology which can't be sold in other markets.
The government will release a discussion paper in September, marking the first steps to introducing a fuel emissions standard. Tech billionaire Mike Cannon-Brookes told the summit the standards need to be compulsory.
We currently have a voluntary standards regime, right? I joke about it, it's like marking your own homework. It's actually not, because no one has to mark the homework. You don't even need to submit the homework. The standards we have no penalties, no regulations, and not even any reporting.
He's encouraged Australia to look overseas for examples of what works. New Zealand has seen electric vehicle sales rise from 3 to 20% of all cars sold in a year. The country's Transport Minister Michael Wood told the conference that's thanks to a new fuel efficiency standard and a significant rebate for new EVs.
Gives people up to $8,625 New Zealand dollars for purchasing a zero emissions or low emissions vehicle. The whole rebate scheme is financially sustainable as it's paid for by charges of up to $5,175 New Zealand dollars on the highest emitting vehicles. The rebates and charges work on a sliding scale based on the emissions profile of the vehicle. And it's working better than we expected. We are now seeing months in New Zealand where the top-selling passenger car of any fuel type produces no emissions.
This week in the US, President Joe Biden signed an Inflation Reduction Act, and one of its measures is to give tax credits to people who buy new and used electric vehicles. Chair of electric car company Tesla, Robin Denholm, says that shows cultural change is possible.
I mean, I spend a lot of time in the US. I've lived in the US. The cars in the US are big. So from my perspective, if the US can actually adopt fuel standards that are much better than ours in terms of, you know, 20 to 30%, then we can do that.
The federal government also wants to do away with several different state-run incentive schemes and opt for a consistent national approach.
Isabel Rowe reporting. Saul Griffith is a renewable energy advocate and the founder and chief scientist at Rewiring Australia. We spoke earlier.
Saul Griffith, the government says it's putting together a national EV strategy which would consider introducing fuel efficiency standards. Is that enough, or does that sound like more discussion papers to you?
Australia loves discussion papers, so that certainly has a rhyme to more of that. But I do think this government has a genuine intention to address emissions, and really the critical path for our vehicle emissions, which is the majority of the emissions in our domestic economy, apart from electricity generation, has to come through electrifying our vehicles and providing it with green electricity. So I think they now know where north is, and maybe there'll be a few more white papers, but I think the market is also dragging them there, given that most vehicle manufacturers globally have announced the date where they're going to make their last petrol or diesel vehicle, and most of those dates are around 2030.
How quickly would a fuel efficiency standard have an impact on prices here? There's still a significant gap between the cost of petrol cars and their equivalents in Australia.
I'm not sure that the emission standard is the most effective technique, because California has an emission standard. It's a big enough market that the world's automakers build vehicles for that market. There's a very good reason that's why most electric vehicles are getting preferentially sold into the California market. Norway is another such market where the government has said it's going to be about emission standards. We may be too small and too late to that emission standards game to get more priority for the Australian market from the international vehicle makers. An emission standard might make petrol or diesel vehicles more expensive. That's a stick. There might be a better pathway here using carrots. If we thought about what really is behind, you know, when you own a petrol vehicle, over the 20 years that vehicle will live, you'll put about $50,000 worth of petrol in it in Australia. That's all oil that we have to import. So that's money that leaves the country. So it is very much in the economic interests of Australia to be generating our own electricity and running our cars on it, because then we save all of those export dollars. And I'd encourage the government to think creatively that, given that every electric vehicle is going to improve Australia's trade balance and create more local jobs, then we should actually be providing carrots to help households buy and afford them.
So let's talk about some of those carrots. It seems at the moment that this discussion about electric vehicles is the chatter amongst city folk. What can the government do to create an uptake in our farm sector or in our rural communities as well as our cities?
Well, I think there's another double-edged sword there. The emission standards, if you bring them in, the vehicles that they will affect the most in the shortest term will be diesel vehicles, which skew regional, and so it will penalise that market. So I think that's bad politics, and I'd be cautious about thinking about those effects. Whereas we know if you own the average Australian petrol or diesel vehicle, it's costing you about 20 cents a kilometre to drive it in fuel costs. If you were running that on Australian solar, an electric vehicle equivalent, it would only be 1 or 2 cents a kilometre. So people will save huge amounts of money on their weekly energy bills and petrol bills specifically. The question is the price difference between the vehicle they have and the electric vehicle they might want, which is still $10,000 or $20,000 premium for the electric vehicle. So I think there's a good argument, given how much money will be saved on foreign oil over the lifetime of the vehicle, for the government to step in with rebates to help Australians drive electric vehicles using Australian sunshine.
We are still hearing anecdotal stories about people on road trips struggling to find fast chargers. Is that setting back the uptake of EVs?
I think that's one of the things. Although I drove from Sydney to Canberra to Adelaide to Melbourne to Hobart and back again twice this year in electric vehicles. And in all but one case where an electric vehicle charger was out of order, I actually found it to be very convenient and quite easy. We're going to put in a lot more vehicle chargers, and that will make even more of the regional situations easier. So we need a lot more charging infrastructure. That's holding us back.
That's Dr. Saul Griffith, the founder of Rewiring Australia and the author of The Big Switch. On ABC Radio, this is The World Today. Thanks for your company. Ukraine has accused Russia of nuclear blackmail while holding high-level talks with the United Nations and Turkey.
The three leaders have warned of pending nuclear catastrophe, with the UN calling on Russia to urgently demilitarise a large nuclear plant in the country's south. Europe correspondent Isabella Higgins reports.
In the centre of the West Ukrainian city of Lviv, the relatives of the Azovstal steel plant prisoners of war rallied. They were hoping to capture the attention of the UN's chief Antonio Guterres and the Turkish president Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who were in town for trilateral talks with Ukraine's president Volodymyr Zelensky.
Secretary General Ms. Guterres and the president of the Republic of Turkey, Mr. Erdogan, representatives to Ukrainian war prisoners in order to check the state of health, condition of detentions and compliance.
The two leaders came to discuss solutions to war, but President Zelensky says there is only one solution for his country.
People who shoot cruise missiles into our peaceful cities don't want peace. That's why, first of all, they must withdraw their troops from our territory, and only then can we talk peace.
Instead, the talk centred on the unfolding situation at the Zaporizhia power plant in the country's south. Europe's largest nuclear complex is still run by Ukrainian workers, but has been under Russian occupation since March. Recently, it has come under heavy shelling. The UN's Antonio Guterres says it's a grave situation.
Agreement is urgently needed to re-establish Zaporizhia as purely civilian infrastructure and to ensure the safety of the area.
Ukraine and the UN agreed to the terms of a deal that would allow inspectors from the agency's nuclear watchdog to visit. But Moscow has already said it's not willing to meet the UN's demands to demilitarize the site, saying it would make it less safe. Mr. Guterres says it's putting lives at risk.
Military equipment and personnel should be withdrawn from the plant, and we must tell it as it is. Any potential damage to Zaporizhia is suicide.
President Erdogan has warned the world does not need another Chernobyl. But workers from inside the plant are warning the situation is growing worse and shows no signs of easing.
Europe correspondent Isabella Higgins there. Wild storms have lashed parts of Europe, wreaking havoc across multiple countries and killing at least 13 people. The storm swept through as firefighters in Spain and Portugal battle severe wildfires. It comes as researchers at an Australian university reveal heat waves are our deadliest natural disasters. Alexandra Humphreys reports.
The storms were unexpected and ferocious. Violent thunderstorms and hurricane-force winds battered the French Mediterranean island of Corsica before crossing Italy's Tuscany region and into Austria. Six people died in Corsica, including a teenage girl. Seven were killed by falling trees in Italy and Austria, two children among them. France's Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin surveyed the damage.
I want to express to Corsica and especially to the families on holidays who lost loved ones or whose loved ones were injured, all the support and the sympathies of the government, which has been working since this morning with all the local government workers to save, rescue and to take account of losses from this terrible meteorological event.
French President Emmanuel Macron called an emergency government meeting in the wake of the storms. Corsica's Executive Council President Gilles Simeoni says campsites have been evacuated.
Looking at this idyllic, peaceful camping site, we can hardly imagine now the apocalyptic scenes that took place this morning as the only witnesses to the violence of the elements. Whole tree trunks were uprooted.
The storms hit amid a summer of drought, heat waves and forest fires across Europe that scientists linked to human-caused climate change. Aggressive wildfires in Spain have burnt through almost 250,000 hectares of land this year. As Europe braces for another heatwave on the way, researchers from James Cook University have released findings from a new study, which shows the weather phenomenon is actually Australia's most deadly natural disaster. Associate lecturer Hannah Mason's authored a review of heatwave studies published over the last two decades.
Heatwaves are considered Australia's most destructive natural hazard in terms of loss of life, and they're increasing in frequency, severity, and spread. So we were just trying to understand what that looks like through a health service demand lens.
Ms. Mason says deaths increase by up to 13% during a heatwave, and between 2 to 15% more people present to emergency departments, while hospital admissions rise by up to 58%.
What we found across the board is heatwaves definitely impact our health service delivery and demand.
Those with some health conditions are particularly at risk. That includes people with cardiovascular, respiratory, renal, neurological and mental health conditions.
When we look at some of the projections into the future, it's clear that this is a growing threat to the health of Australians, and it's something that we really need to pay good attention to.
Hannah Mason from James Cook University, ending that story by Alexandra Humphreys. Well, every time you stand in front of the egg cartons at the supermarket, you have a choice to make. Do you get the caged eggs or the free-range ones that are a little pricier? Eggs from caged hens are being phased out, but it'll be 14 years before they're entirely removed from our supermarket shelves. And farmers say the transition process should be even longer. Angus Randall reports.
You might not be making plans that look 14 years into the future, but egg farmer and elected director of Australian Eggs, Bede Burke, says he has to make financial decisions now that could take over a decade to pay off.
Look, industry's calling on a lot more time. In terms of agricultural assets, it's unprecedented.
Eggs from battery-caged chickens are being phased out by 2036 as part of new national poultry standards. Industry groups had pushed for that transition to be extended to 2046, 24 years from now. Bede Burke says many farmers are still paying off debts coming from the last time the rules were changed to improve conditions for birds.
To move from a cage system to a non-cage system, there's considerable cost. And you can't do that if your assets haven't been fully depreciated and paid back. That's the fundamental problem that we have. And as egg producers, look, we have a fundamental belief that consumers should have access to the cheapest and most affordable product as well, which is in the form of caged eggs.
Caged egg farming is big business. There are around 19 million commercial layer hens in Australia, and just under a third are caged. And while farmers are saying slow down, animal rights groups want the phase-out to hurry up. Nicola Bynan is the head of campaigns at the Humane Society International.
Hens in battery cages are the most intensively confined animals in farming today. They get less room than an A4 piece of paper. This means they cannot carry out their natural behaviours. They can't roost, they can't nest, they can't forage. They can't even spread their wings.
Not all hens will live a free-range life under the incoming standards. From 2036, hens can still be caged as long as they have 10 square metres of usable space. Nicola Bynan says egg farmers have nothing to complain about.
The pace of that phase-out is really set by industry needs. It's basically the time frame for existing systems to be decommissioned anyway.
New Zealand ended a 10-year phase-out of battery cages this year, and most of Europe banned their use in 2012. Professor Christine Parker is from the Melbourne Law School, where she teaches food and animal law. She says the end of caged eggs will bring Australia into line with the rest of the world.
When Australia is lagging behind and not banning the cages, then it looks like we don't care about animal welfare, and I think that harms our reputation for all the other animal-related products that we export.
And she believes the egg industry should have known this was coming.
So the industry has known for 7 or 8 years that there's definitely going to be something happening to phase out battery cages. So they've had all that time to prepare. They've also known since, I don't know, the mid-90s that the Australian public don't like the idea of keeping sentient, intelligent animals in cages.
But farmer Bede Burke argues it's easy to call for industry changes when you're not the ones who have to change.
See, they haven't got a dollar in the game. They don't spend a cent providing the security of egg supply to consumers. All they do is sit out the side and comment, and they don't have the risk that we have.
The welfare guidelines come into full effect on July 1st, 2036, and will also improve living standards for other poultry, including meat, chickens, ducks and geese.
Angus Randall there, and that's all from the World Today team for this week. The program's supervising producer is David Sparks. Today's program was produced by Catherine Gregory. Associate producer is Barney Porter. Technical production by Nick Dan and Kim White. We'll be back at the same time on Monday. Have a great weekend.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. The FBI raid that saw classified documents seized from Donald Trump's home doesn't seem to have dented his political ambitions or influence on the Republican Party. Today, US national security expert Karen Greenberg on a dangerous time in American politics. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.